Oh, yikes, I'm going to be late. I have to go do a podcast. They're like jury duty now.
This is the Extra Hot Great Podcast, episode 385 for the week of December 13th, 2021. I am NARM Cinematic Universe David T. Cole, and I'm here with grieving fascinator Sarah D. Bunting.
It's flat like my FX.
Irate Peloton shareholder Tara Ariano.
Sell!
Rude bus splashing you with city filth Heather Cox.
Sorry, not sorry about your adult tutu.
And post-it note breaker-upper Jessica Morgan.
Don't hate me, I can't.
Welcome to Extra Hot Grade for another week. Joining us, you've already heard them up top. They're the co-writers of The Royal We and The Air Affair, among other novels, and the fashion critics behind Go Fug Yourself. It's Heather Cox and Jessica Morgan!
Yay! Heather and Jessica!
Yay! Woo! We are here, of course, to talk about And Just Like That. We all know Sex and the City, the sitcom that ran for six seasons on HBO, and spawned two follow-up feature films. But aren't you curious about how things are going for the ladies and the city 11 years after that second movie no one liked? That's the premise of And Just Like That, HBO Max's new series, which is exactly Sex and the City, more or less, except Samantha is famously no longer there. The first two episodes dropped last week. We will be talking about them in detail. Two more screeners were provided, but if those come up, we will be careful about spoilers. Let's do the Chen check-in. Starting with Heather, should our listeners watch And Just Like That, yes or no?
I'm going to say no.
Okay. Jessica?
I'm going to say okay.
Okay. Sarah?
Nope.
Dave?
Big no.
I give you permission to watch it. That's kind of where I'm going to put it down there.
Okay.
I feel fair about this the way I did about Many Saints of Newark, which is people who love the show are going to watch it, and it won't matter how good or bad it is.
That's exactly right. What I mean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah.
That's what I meant by okay.
Yeah, exactly.
We're all speaking different languages. We mean the same thing.
Yes.
So let's start with the elephant not in the room, Samantha. She's not dead. She's just living in London. How did you feel about the way the show handled the real life effects of what is apparently a blood feud between Kim Cattrall and Sarah Jessica Parker? Heather, let's start with you.
I find that in general, one of my notes on this show, and that applies to things in the next episodes, but I won't say which, this show tends to create problems for itself that it could have avoided. And I think the Samantha issue was a big one. I do understand that it's difficult because you've killed Big. Kim Cattrall is not going to show up for that.
Yeah.
But I still think there was a better way to handle that. Like, hi, COVID does technically still exist. She could be in quarantine for two weeks. Maybe she can't come. The way that they did it felt very much like the writers, and I say the writers, but I really generally mean Michael Patrick King and Sarah Jessica Parker. I just felt like they were having Carrie tell the story to Miranda of Samantha having fled to London in a huff and ghosting them. I think that felt like a conversation that was them trying to absolve themselves of any responsibility for Kim Cattrall being absent.
Totally.
It was very like, we really tried so hard and like, she's a lunatic, so whatever, nothing we can do. I was not a big watcher of the show the first time around, and I tried to watch a bunch of it before this came out. And what I came away from was that Samantha is like a really super loyal, steadfast ride or die for most of these women.
Yeah.
Actually, for all of them. And it didn't make any sense. Not only did it not make sense, but like, I can't remember at this point how successful of a writer Carrie supposedly is. But if she's grasping at money doing this podcast, I can't imagine it's very much. So why does she supposedly have a publicist on retainer anyway? And if she's telling Samantha, like, yeah, the book business sucks, I don't think I can afford a publicist right now, Samantha's not going to care, and her business isn't going to be dependent on this. Like, the whole thing totally fell apart. Like, I don't understand any of those decisions. It's so easy to poke holes through all of this, and it completely, as I said on our website, they didn't kill Samantha, but they sure stabbed her in the back a bunch of times.
Ooh, Jessica, what were your thoughts on this?
I mean, I agree. I just feel like, I don't know, there's a better way to handle this. I get that she's not available, but there's a ton of stuff you could do that wasn't like nonsensical, obviously. Like all these people who work in the show are well aware of the fact that someone of Carrie's career level does not have a publicist on retainer.
Yeah.
Because a lot of them have probably written books and Darren Star maybe did. Michael Patrick King might have a publicist on retainer, but like, this is absurd.
Yeah.
No book writer has a publicist on retainer. You guys are making... This is one of those things that always makes me crazy, where I watch a show and I think, I know the writer knows this is not true. Mm-hmm. So right. Why are you trying to sell it to us as if this is legitimate? I mean, I said to Heather, like, why don't you have Samantha fall in love with some low-level rich aristocrat, and now she lives in the middle of nowhere in England, and yada, yada, yada. You can come up with some reason why she's not there for big. Mm-hmm. But, like, it's just, this is, it. I feel like I kind of enjoyed this show as a whole, but starting off with this conversation between Carrie and Miranda, where they're, like, kind of shit-talking Samantha and laying out this, like, very irrational plot choice, mm-hmm. sort of starts it off on a sour note.
Yeah. Especially with the whole cutesy conversation at the very beginning when someone recognizes them in the restaurant and then they say where's Samantha, and Charlotte's like, oh, she's not with us anymore. Yeah. And the woman obviously thinks it means she's dead and Charlotte has to correct her. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, so you're going to take that sort of winky, winky, cutesy approach. And then like 30 seconds later, Carrie's outside moping about how Samantha has dumped her as a friend because she dumped her as a publicist or mm-hmm. whatever, which tonally, those two things don't add up. And the story itself doesn't make sense.
I feel like, they could have just done something wild and been like, can you believe Samantha got chosen to be on the International Space Station? I really miss her.
They already did it on Saved by the Bell, so they couldn't.
Oh, did they? That's funny. That's I didn't watch that.
Screech was. Although in Saved by the Bell, they did that in season one. They sent him up to the space station. And then in season two, after the actor died, they just like pretend he died. But like, I know you can't do it, but I'm just saying, have the International Space Station crash in the Saved by the Bell universe and like really marry everything together.
Space!
I really am I so enjoy that we've managed to cross Saved by the Bell and the Sex and the City universes in this manner.
What if with Samantha, they sort of did the same thing they kind of did with the Marvel characters when they did Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which was mm-hmm. the first like shitty low-budge TV show to come out of that universe, which is like, oh, you just missed Thor.
Or with the X-Files, to take it even further back, Jessica knows, where they were like, oh, Fox Mulder's here. He's just out getting the dry cleaning.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, in fairness, I think that was a joke that I made and was mm-hmm. not the joke that the show made. But yeah, he was like off doing something.
Right.
Well, I mean, they did this with Brenda Walsh. She's in London, and like they'd cut into a scene and be like, all right, thanks, Brenda, bye. Mm-hmm. And then Brenda would be like, she's doing great.
She sent a telegram for your wedding. Okay, when are we?
Right.
Yeah.
Sarah, I can tell from your face you were also furious about the Samantha of it all. So please cap off our discussion here.
I won't belabor that particular point because it's like of all the characters who would do something like this, she is the last.
Yes.
Carrie mm-hmm. would fully do something like this, but not, or like she did actually. And she went to Paris and the only reason she called home was to whine about how Baryshnikov wasn't spending enough time with her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this show, I've always had deeply mixed feelings about this show. And I think that they always had like tonal control problems mm-hmm. and realism problems and diversity problems. But every now and then they would nail the ways that best friends are with each other, like on the sweet spot so hard. And they do that in a couple of the opening episodes, like when Miranda and Carrie are spooning
mm-hmm.
that I was just like,
I did too.
But, you know, many of those moments involved Samantha. And for them to have this whole Chrissy Snow, you know, I fired her and then she ghosted all of us conversation about her is just like, look, it's like when, I don't know, Real Housewives go to the Bahamas to fight about stuff. Like, we're way ahead of you in the news cycle. We know what this is about.
Yeah.
Just say she's in quarantine at the airport
mm-hmm.
and end it. And then that she would send those flowers that Carrie didn't want. And Carrie would be like, all better. I accept them. Like, I don't believe any of that was true. And there were a half a hundred other ways they could have done it that they should have done it. But mm-hmm. this is just one of those things, like they had every opportunity also to just look at this and be like, this is not working, or this needs to be a third movie about the end of this affair, or. But like, to go from a first episode capper that's a voiceover and just like that Big died to Brady fucking in the next episode is like, who is fucking driving this car? Yeah. Because I want out and I don't have to slow down. I'm just going to fucking tuck and roll right now. Like, there were so many infuriating things about this that the Samantha thing, like, by the time I got to the end of the second episode, I was like, this is like fifth on my list of like rage, basically.
Yeah.
And, you know, Samantha's not the only one who got thrown under the bus. She just got to not be present while it was happening. Mm-hmm. Miranda's got a, like, former governor candidate Cynthia Nixon has to stand there and act like this was the character.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Brutal. Just brutal.
And Steve, like, I don't know what the world's feelings are about Steve, but I got a far enough on my rewatch that I was sort of like, Steve's sort of like a fine, lovable doof, but like, he's a very sexual person and he was really tolerant and kind of adored Miranda. Mm-hmm. And they have just like stomped all over him, like from the movie when he cheated on her just so she had a storyline.
Yeah.
And then now he's like this doddering, like sexless, half deaf, clueless old man. And you're like, why is this happening to Steve? Like, is there, it almost makes me worry that in episode like 7 or something, there's one joke somebody thought of in the shower that has to do with Steve being deaf. And they were like, let's work backwards. and that's the one payoff. Cause otherwise I don't understand it. And I don't know why Steve always has to just sort of become twisted so that Miranda has something to do.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, someone pointed out on Go Fug Yourself when we were talking about this, the commenter was like, when I was watching this, I was thinking, how old was Steve all along? Like, is Steve older than I think he is? But he's not. It's weird. Like, I don't know. I actually have a lot of fondness for the show. I agree with Sarah that, like, I have notes and I always had notes.
Yeah.
But I think one of the things about it that was always interesting to me, in addition to, like, I agree with you that they sometimes really nailed like the best friendship stuff. One of the things I always thought was interesting is that I do think they let their protagonists be terrible sometimes.
Yes.
And it wasn't terrible in a way that like Dawson Leary was terrible, but we were supposed to think he was great.
Right.
Like, you were allowed to be like, wow,
Screech and Dawson in this conversation.
Yes.
Testify.
We're and Mulder. Like, we're really hitting all the
90s icons.
We are.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Truly. And Brenda Walsh. Like, we have really done it already. And I do like that they're still kind of doing that, but it feels a little less intentional in this one.
Yeah.
But when people would do something asshole-ish in these episodes, I would think to myself, this is in character. This person is an asshole sometimes. Like, Carrie Bradshaw is a total asshole sometimes.
Oh,
and I think the show realizes that about her. Mm-hmm. And I do think that is interesting, and it has become very unusual.
Yeah. I mean,
For women, anyway.
Yeah. I dipped in on the original series, too. And there certainly were some ways where I thought, like, this is how people are assholes in their 30s, and people being assholes in their 50s is a different kind of thing.
That's a good point. That is true.
I thought, you know, not that I'm in my 50s yet. I mean, touch wood that I even get there. God. But yeah, I just thought that...
Something wrong with you, I should know?
Okay. You know,
dark.
Anything can happen. We learned that from this show. But yeah, I just thought the Steve thing was like, we're trying to show the full range of things that happen to you when you're at this stage of life, including your spouse dies or your spouse goes deaf or whatever. Your daughter doesn't want to wear the Oscar de la Renta dress that you bought for her.
Yeah. I feel like they took a checklist of things and just sort of grafted it onto the show in different ways. And in the end, it left me with something like parts of it made me mad. Parts of it, there's one bit in the third episode where I think it's the third or the fourth. I won't specify what it is, but where I wrote down something that I thought was a real asshole move. And then the show called it out later in the episode. And I was like, okay. But that was, to me, that almost felt like the only time that it actually acknowledged that Carrie was a jerk.
Right.
And I often find that even when she's acting like a jerk, the show is sort of expects you. And in fact, of all of these people, they sort of want to absolve them of it anyway. And I found that like a lot of the promising new characters that they've introduced exist for these women to behave stupidly. And then these new characters sort of pat them on the head and are okay with it anyway.
Yeah.
Like Miranda's behavior in class or some of the ways that Charlotte is navigating this new friendship with
Lisa
Todd Wexley, LTW or whatever. And in the end, it's like they're basically sort of being given permission by these characters to be embarrassing or like to be kind of up in their own shit and exhausting and awful. And I didn't love that. I think you know, it's interesting that there's been a lot of talk in the media about how the women look now. And I think some of the discussion about the show has been them saying, well, what's wrong with us having gray hair? Like, why is it that nobody wants to hear stories about these women just because we're over 50 or whatever? Like, why is there no longer an interest in stories about women this age? And my response to that after watching the show was, I am interested in seeing stories about women this age. I just don't think I'm interested in seeing stories about these women at this age.
Yeah.
I just am not sure that it works. And I think it's the one thing that I will respect the Friends cast for if they hold the line forever, which is knowing and understanding that your show was a time capsule and it mm-hmm. should be a time capsule. Like, to me, Sex and the City, they were so specifically of a time and they were so specifically about, yeah, women in their 30s and then Samantha, however old she really was, mm-hmm. but like ageless. Navigating New York City in that exact particular era yeah. with those exact particular like curious life situations where it's like, how can Carrie afford the shoes in the apartment? Sometimes she can't, sometimes she can. But now that we're following these women into their 50s, or some of that just doesn't track for me anymore. Like I was okay with where we left them. I was okay with them telling those stories in that moment. I'm not that interested in 2021 in a story about a woman who is grieving, but has enough money that she has kept her old apartment so that if the love of her life dies, she can yes. just go back to the other place.
Yeah, I do agree.
Which, by the way, she's apparently been paying someone to clean for the last 11 years or however long it's been, because there were no cobwebs or rats or roaches anywhere. And all her stuff was in there.
Yeah.
So And I'm not saying, you know, whatever. Like, I just am not as interested in that New York lifestyle anymore, where like they have literally nothing to worry about except, you know, what their friend group looks like, as Charlotte is worried about, or any of that stuff. Right. And I'm kind of like, I don't think you are the voices of these stories that I was looking for.
Yeah,
I think I like this better than all of you. There are times when I like sincerely enjoyed watching it. There are other times when I thought it was a mess, but I thought the thing that was messy was interesting, sort of like,
yeah.
I was interested in seeing how they got there. I think Sarah Jessica Parker's performance was quite good. Like, I think in the second episode,
yeah, I
she's
agree,
great.
Actually.
And I think there is something comforting about watching. This sounds so like it's a very low bar, you guys, but like something really comforting in watching a show where all of the actors are like fucking pros and these people are going to do a good job mm-hmm. and it's not going to be someone just like flailing in a part that they're miscast for.
Yeah.
I think there is something comforting about that. I did like seeing it filmed on location because I feel like I haven't seen New York in real life mm-hmm. for a really long time. And that was fun. Mm-hmm. So I am sort of like, I don't think it's a great ride, but I'm on it and yeah. I'm going to probably stay on it.
That's how I feel too.
And
I'm like, I really didn't like it and I'm still going to keep watching it.
Oh, yeah. Same.
And I also think, but to Heather's sort of point here, all of that being said, I really loved the way they ended the original series. It was a mm-hmm. great ending. And mm-hmm. I thought they undid all of it with the movies, but you can kind of like pretend the movies don't really exist.
Sure.
And I just wish with so many things, like allegedly they're rebooting 6 Feet Under, that's a whole mm-hmm. other ball of wax, a terrible idea. Let great things that ended well stay done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Have any of these reboots ever really given us something we need?
Yeah.
No.
And it's interesting because, well, one reason I will stick around is that I believe the hilarious and great Samantha Irby wrote one of the episodes that's coming up. I want to say it's episode 6,
it's
but
6.
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is 6.
So I want to see that one. But she made a comment somewhere, and I'm so sorry that I can't remember where.
It's in Vogue.
Is it where she was like, we want to see stories yeah. about women banging or all kinds of ages or yes. whatever,
oh, yeah.
ages and stages. And yeah. I totally support that too. And I'm very curious as to when they're going to get to that, because Steve is not the only sexless person in the show. I sort of feel like the whole thing is very sterile, except for Brady, which is like, I know.
Yeah.
No. Don't care.
Yeah, pass
forward.
Stop.
So I'm wondering, because I think fans of the original will watch it, obviously, no matter what. But I do think tonally what they're getting, even across the next two episodes that are coming up, is still very different than what they might remember. And I think it's, again, very just sort of, it's sexless. I don't know how else to say it. Like, it's sexless in the city.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, like, the chemistry between Miranda and Che when they're sort of like apologizing to each other about that like Brady pot mm-hmm. meltdown at the memorial, I was like,
can these two start banging like now? Because yes, they both want to. It's very obvious. And yep, I would watch the hell out of whatever spinoff that is. But the rest of it is just like, look, I'm going to watch it and hope that they like bring it back around, mm-hmm, because my frustrations with the original are basically like ported over to this. It's just like, it's like Heather was saying, like, I'm not sure that these stories, like, we're diverging more and more from relatability with every iteration of this franchise. And I just think it's like, okay, this was attempted. Let's really wrap it up this time.
Mm-hmm. Although I will say, like, Sarah Ramirez is very charismatic. They were more charismatic than anyone on Grey's put together. Mm-hmm. And I was happy to see them on TV again because I skipped Madam Secretary and just... I don't know. I'm very interested to see where they go because, and I agree with you that I think that their chemistry with Miranda was fantastic.
Yeah, that was a good scene.
My only problem with that character and those scenes, like the podcast scene in the first episode especially, is like, I know it's nominally a comedy, but I feel like the parts where they try to be funny with like the, you know, hanging a lampshade on how dad jokey the jokes are, like they're so corny, and when it tries to be topical it's less good than when it tries to be just like quietly effective, which is why I thought the second episode was better. I mean, we already said that Sarah Jessica Parker did a good job with that, and I think generally for me she's better slash maybe just more bearable when she's dealing with the difficult emotions than when she's like being an irritating moron and you're supposed to think it's cute, where it's like, you're 38, like get your shit together, pay your rent, what's wrong with you? Anyway, so yeah, that was my only disappointment with the Sarah Ramirez character. It's like, oh no, don't be here. Don't be doing this, hitting your button for the woke moment. It's like, ooh.
Yeah, I thought the podcast stuff was really not great. Like, I don't want to listen to that show. No. And also, Carrie being a prude was sort of hilarious to me because I was like, oh yeah, she was like this in the original series also. For a sex columnist, she's very like uptight about talking about sex. It's very odd to me.
Everybody banging with their bras on. Okay.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
That sort of boggles the mind how she was a successful sex columnist.
I don't even know if she really was. I mean, I remember that episode where she's getting $4 a word for Vogue because I remember I caught it on a rerun and I was like, oh my God, if only people were still getting $4 a word, this would be delightful. I always kind of felt like, you know, Candace Bushnell is much more successful than Carrie Bradshaw, much more. And I don't know. I just don't think they're very good at that part of it. But watching her on this podcast, I'm thinking, yeah, this is right. Like, you're not, how did you get this gig? I guess because you're a successful sex columnist, but you're very bad at talking about this. Mm-hmm.
I mean, Jenny Garth and Tori Spelling, renewed for season 3. Oh, don't actually have to be good at it.
It's crazy. I generally have I find comedian characters awkward when what the show is asking you to do is watch their comedy. And then it's like, see, look how funny this comedy is. It's such funny comedy. And there's a lot of that sort of, but when the character who is a comedian is just allowed to be a character, like the scenes with Miranda and stuff, then it works better.
Absolutely. But yes, to your point, they had to cut to the producer laughing at their jokes recording the podcast.
Oh, no, you can't.
Two times in one scene. It's like, we see what you're doing. It's not working.
We also watched Punchline. Didn't anyone learn anything from this?
Come on. Sure did.
Although, I did write down, Carrie, bang that podcast producer.
Yeah,
so
he's hot.
Let's cross our fingers.
Oh, he is hot.
He seems like too pointedly hot. Mm-hmm. For it to just be like passing.
To not bang.
Someone has to bang that guy.
All right. So we've talked about Lisa, the other mom from Charlotte's kids school, and Che, and a little bit about the kids who are now big enough to be characters slash annoying in their own right. The only other new character that we meet really in the first couple of episodes is Naya, the professor that Miranda embarrasses herself in front of. And I was glad to see her because I love Karen Pittman, but she was my favorite of the new characters. Sarah, how would you rate them?
Sarah Ramirez was, I think, my favorite. But I mean, so many of the new characters are, as we said before, just there to reflect like white lady try-hardiness in this, you know, woke moment regard back to them in a positive way and make them, and I think certain viewers, feel better about themselves. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's sort of hard. it's sort of hard to rate them, but in terms of like the difficulty rating of what they're being asked to do, Naya is definitely, I think, the toughest needle to thread.
Yeah.
During those scenes, I just wanted to be dead. Like they're horrible. They're so horrible. Mm-hmm. They're just assassinating everybody involved. And like, I just am wondering what it was like to get those script pages and be like, oh, we're actually doing this out loud, all the words? Huh. Who am I wearing during this?
Oh, I mean, she looks, she has my favorite wardrobe for sure. The pants that she's wearing in that first scene were maybe in this house for a time and then I didn't end up keeping them. But yeah, when they're having that conversation on the subway platform in the first episode, and then she's like, and then Miranda gets on and she's like, just drifts away to a different car. That was very good, and maybe not in the script, and if not, great, because that's what needed to happen.
Perfect. Yeah.
Jessica, who was your favorite of the new characters? Or least?
I actually have to say, I think all of the new characters are working in a way that I, like, performance-wise, they're all doing a great job. And I am sort of interested in seeing where all of these women go. And I hope that, although I don't really expect this to happen, I would like us to spend sort of more time with them without the core three women. Like, I don't know that we need to be hanging out with, I mean, why can't we just sort of follow them for a while? Like, we got a little bit of it with Karen Pittman's character talking to her husband about the IVF, but can we just like maybe hang out with these other ladies for a little while?
Yeah.
Like, I thought they all, I don't know if that I have a favorite yet. Although I love LTW's outfits. They are great. She loves an accessory.
She does.
As Heather pointed out to me in this, I think it's the second episode, she's wearing a dress that looks like it has earrings all over
it.
Yes. Which is really fun. She's also wearing giant earrings.
And a huge statement necklace too.
Yes. And so I think the wardrobe on them has all been really fun, which, you know, that is one of the reasons we're watching that show.
That's true.
Let's just be honest. And also, this is a little bit of a sidebar, but I think the clothing is looking better on film than it did in the shots from the set.
Yes.
Which is fun. But yeah, I don't know that I have a favorite yet, but I will say that I was like sort of pleasantly surprised by how much I enjoyed the new characters. Cause sometimes I feel like new characters do feel like just in and of themselves, not necessarily their interactions with the main three, which were agonizing.
Yeah.
But you know, so often shows like this, I think when they add in new people, the new people feel superfluous. And in this case, I was like, oh, I could see why all of these characters are sort of they're interesting. Like, I would be, I'm interested in seeing where these people go. So that I think was kind of a surprise for me.
Heather, what about you?
I feel similarly. I wish they weren't all there to sort of make everyone else feel better about themselves.
Yes.
You know, there was a moment, I think it's Mario Cantone refers to LTW as Black Charlotte.
Oh, yes.
And I was like, I really wish that I didn't feel like that was how she was written as a log line in the writer's room.
Totally agree.
I think that's not good on a lot of reasons, on a lot of levels. And I also think it sort of does a disservice to what that actor and what that character could be.
Yeah.
So I would really like to see her not be Black Charlotte as the show defines her.
Yeah.
That didn't sit with me. And I mean, it's hard to argue with. Che is interesting and good, and that works out. I hope that the direction that is moving ends up being as foxy as we hope it will be. I just want to cliffhang for people that in the two episodes upcoming, there is something that happens that I hate so much that I texted Jessica and spoiled her on it so that I could complain about it. I'm not going to tell you what it was. So watch the show, see what I hated. See if you can guess.
It is time to go around the dial. Our first stop is Tara.
Speaking of HBO Max originals, Love Life Season 2. Love Life was one of the launch titles when HBO Max went online last year. It starred Anna Kendrick and was a quasi-anthology series following her character at various pivotal moments in, as the title suggests, her love life. And I think I got through three because Anna Kendrick is very annoying to me. But then I saw there was a second season revolving around a whole other character, and I kept hearing it was much better, and I'm here to say that is true. The first episode starts out at the wedding of Kendrick's character, Darby. One of the guests is Marcus, played by William Jackson Harper from The Good Place. He played Chidi. And
I said yay.
Oh, yes, he's great. He's the star of season two. His wife, Emily, played by Maya Kazan, works with Darby. That's the loose, very loose connection. And so Marcus is outside vaping when he meets Mia, played by Jessica Williams, and they're very flirty. So when he mentions his wife, Mia is a little bit surprised. And when he points her out and Mia sees that his wife is white, she says, "That makes sense." And it gets under his skin a little bit. Mia and Marcus keep talking and texting, and the more time he spends chatting with a black woman and seeing how much life experience they have in common, the more he starts to notice how the racial differences between himself and his wife actually matter more to him than he had ever really thought about. And as in season one, there's a time jump noted between episodes as we step from big moment to big moment in Marcus's love life. And I'm not qualified to talk about what the season gets right or wrong about dating in the 2010s, never mind as a black person, obviously, which is why I was so glad our past guest, Brittany Luce, has revived her podcast for Colored Nerds, and that their most recent episode is about this season. And she and her co-host, Eric Eddings, had a great discussion about the ways the season portrays the issues that can arise in an interracial dating situation. Rather than do a bad job of recapping what they said more, I will just tell everyone, watch this season, which is fantastic. Listen to their episode about it when you're done. We will link that in the show notes. But everyone is great. Great casting, great performances. Ignore season one, skip straight to season two. You're fine. And I also watched live in front of a studio audience. We've talked about these when ABC has done them in the past. Jimmy Kimmel and Norman Lear pick out an episode of an old multicam sitcom, then cast it with new actors and restage it as a special, not just film, but also broadcast live in front of a studio audience. And they first did it as a sweeps gimmick in May 2019 with back-to-back episodes of All in the Family and the Jeffersons. And then they came back in December with Good Times. And then people were really filming things in front of studio audiences for a while. But now it's back. And last week, you got back-to-back episodes of Facts of Life and the show it spun off from, which is called Sarah. Different Strokes.
Different Strokes. Sorry.
Okay. The two episodes they picked weren't really related at all. When they did All the Family, it was the first episode that George Jefferson appeared in, and then the Jeffersons pilot. It's also weird Different Strokes wasn't first, since it spawned the other, but for all of these, once you hear who they cast in all of the parts, that's like 75% of the enjoyment that you're going to get out of this, sure. Honestly. Even if you have fond feelings for the shows, which I did more so for these two because they were more like of my youth than the other ones. So you've got Jennifer Aniston as Blair in Facts of Life, Catherine Hahn as Jo, Alison Tolman as Natalie, Gabrielle Union as Tootie, Anne Dowd as Mrs. Garrett. She and Tolman are the only ones who seem like they're really trying to act, with the rest kind of mugging through it like they're doing a skit at a camp talent show. But there's also a nerd boy played by Jon Stewart, not off book from what we could tell, a role originally played by Dan Frischman, who was Arvid on Head of the Class, and also Will Arnett and Jason Bateman truly just fucking around, letting the wigs and the costumes do all the work. But we also get Lisa Welchel, the original Blair, back in her Eastland uniform to sing the theme song live. She looks, sounds good, looks unbelievable. It was like witch time, how good she looked.
It was insane.
Different Strokes is an even less successful experiment, in my opinion. Dowd is back as Mrs. Garrett, of course, with John Lithgow as Mr. Drummond. He was good. Damon Wayans as Willis, Kevin Hart as Arnold, and then the surprise guest playing Willis's friend Vernon is Snoop Dogg. Wayans and Hart go up on their lines a lot. In Hart's case, that includes the very last gag of the episode, which they added and he kind of wrecked. But other than the two of them, it's kind of touching to watch Dowd and Lithgow perform it like a stage farce. And I should also say, Snoop Dogg comes across very prepared and professional, unlike the leads. Like, he was good. And I guess I'm a mark, because even though they're never really that great, I will always watch these. And it sort of lights up the same pleasure center as watching bloopers does. There's something just irresistible about seeing people have fun. And now that they've done the 70s and 80s, I was thinking ahead to what 90s sitcom and its spinoff might be attempted next. Like, what if they did Cheers and Frasier? And then I was like, but those were just on. And then I remembered the Cheers series finale was almost 30 years ago. And then I had to go lie down. So Love Life is on HBO Max. That live special is on Hulu at the moment. And for my plugs, I wrote about Doogie Kamealoha MD, now that the season is over, at Decider. Very, very cute remake of that show. And there's a ton of Succession season three finale stuff that you can also find. Goodbye, Succession, for another season. It was kind of a mixed bag this year. But anyway, we'll link that in the show notes as well.
Heather, what do you have for us today?
I have a show that may be on its last legs, but stick with me. Basically, I love to try anything. I love when a show surprises me. I think often show trailers and show commercials are awful. Like, they're cut by people who have no idea what the show is. So when I saw the trailer for The Big Leap, I was like, either this show is going to be maybe surprisingly good, although honestly, I was not expecting that. Or I thought maybe it was going to be a good old-fashioned rage blackout, like Under the Dome, for example. The show you stick with because you love how much it makes your blood boil.
Yes.
And it reminded me, from the way Fox was promoting The Big Leap, it reminded me of that show where Ted Mosby, Josh Radnor, like, white saviored all over a musical theater company that didn't need his help in high school or something. Like, it was just the most smug and awful show. And that they were promoting The Big Leap as Scott Foley creates this dance reality show and it's going to change everyone's lives. And I was just like, this looks so bad. I'm pretty sure that, like, I'm going to have a really good time hating this first episode. And I'm so glad I tried it because it was delightful.
It's so good.
It's so good. And I it's interesting because sometimes you're like, I don't know why this works so well, but it really does. First of all, whoever cuts the promos for Fox does maybe need to be put in timeout because they completely missed the tone of the show. The show is so much wittier and more acidic at times than the trailer, the schmaltz that the trailer would lead you to expect. You know, there was a lot of really good passing jokes that you missed, like Scott Foley's office and this reality TV company had posters for some of their other shows, and one of them was "What's Under That Tarp?" and the other one was like "The Great American Staring Contest."
Amazing!
And, like they would, and the references they would make, or like What's the TV producer tarp? Who suggests that season two for The Big Leap they need to add a kangaroo, and he's deadly serious. It's like it's Thomas Lennon plays the network executive with so much, like, it makes you wonder how their Fox network executive felt about it. But it's just like the characters all work. The chemistry worked. The times that they hit you in the feelings, somehow you're like, I know they want me to cry. I know they want me to cry. I'm crying anyway. You've earned it. The cast members that can't really dance, they work around it really well. And the ones that can, they use so brilliantly. There's one episode where they're having a, they're all somewhere. I can't remember where. They're at a hotel and they do one of those oneers where it's like the camera never cuts. It just goes all the way through this massive hotel party that they're having at all different rooms. And it follows all the cast members from this reality show about dancing who are dancing in and out of the frame, doing shots, doing whatever. And it's so well done. It has so much energy. Like, it's 11 episodes that will really sweep you away. And that's when we get to the part where it's maybe probably going to get canceled. We're not sure. Try it anyway, because even if it never has another episode, the 11 episodes they give you will make you feel fulfilled. You'll be glad you saw it. You won't understand how they made Swan Lake work with a cover of TLC's No Scrubs, but they did. You will love seeing one of the actresses from Gallivant again. Scott Foley's very funny. And if it does well enough on Hulu, which is where I believe the episodes now live, now that it's no longer on Fox, there's always a chance that it will come back for a season two. And it's ready if we are. So I would love for you all to give it a shot anytime you kind of want something nice and something that really genuinely will make you think that there are people out there trying something with good intentions and creative intentions.
I loved it too. I have 3 episodes to go and I'm like saving them because...
Oh my God. It's so like my friend Harry and I watched it together. We would text each other after every episode and be like, that wasn't the last one, was it? There's more. We're like, yes, there's more. And then when we knew it was the last one, we had to like grieve together. But like it's...
Yeah.
It's earned tears. It's earned happiness. It's creativity. Vulture did a big piece about it as well that was like, here's all the times it stuck the landing. And the tone of that was very much like, some of these, you say that out loud in a meeting and you're like, why would you think that would ever work? And it worked so well. So anyway, so please watch that. And my other plug was, for spoilery reasons to come, I decided to watch the X-Files pilot. And that was kind of fun. it was unexpected. I was sort of like, oh, I could see why this show was a hit. And I guess our personal plugs would just be, you can find us on social media, on Twitter and Instagram, both at Fug Girls, FUGGIRLS. And you can find us on our website, gofugyourself.com, where we'll be talking about, you know, all kinds of fashion. And then as we roll into award season without the Golden Globes for the first time, that will be an interesting one to see. And yeah, that's me.
Great.
Sarah, your turn. What do you got?
I am here to talk about the monkeys. The Thinking Girls monkey, Mike Nesmith, died last week. So naturally, I went down an Apple Music shuffle hole with their music, most of which really holds up.
And then I decided to check out a couple of episodes. And, you know, for the seemingly obvious Tangled music rights reasons, they're not really on streaming, although you can find various episodes on YouTube and Dailymotion. The authorities kind of like whack-a-mole them as needed, but then they pop back up again. I watched a couple, and, you know, like, I'm going to say 2 decades ago is when I bought Tara the box set of the show on DVD. Kids, ask your parents. I don't think we made it through an entire disc. The 27-minute runtime, the risible production, quote, values, it just really started feeling like a chore. So I think we ended up watching Clone High again. But it's interesting to watch the show now. Actually, interesting is not quite the right word, because the show itself is still kind of a trial to get through. But I feel like there are stages of how we receive the monkeys, especially people around our age who remember The Second Coming, so to speak, in the mid-80s and bonded with the show at that time. Like, there were episodes that we knew were dumb even back then when we were 12, like the one in the ghost town with Lon Chaney Jr. somehow and Rose Marie from the Dick Van Dyke Show.
Yeah.
And when they came up in the daily rotation on MTV, you were like, oh, this. But mostly you were just into the music and the boys in tight 60s pants because you were a tween and that's who the monkeys and their show were for. And then you revisit it as an adult Gen Xer, and it all feels really dated and strained and hard to sit through. And there's so much montaging and chase footage and laugh-in type humor that doesn't translate. But then you revisit it again as an old lady who, in the time between today and the last time she watched a Monkees episode, had to teach 20-year-olds about classic TV and why we should care about it even when it stinks. And I can't necessarily recommend kicking back with a half hour of the show, but it is instructive as to its time and as to both how television and how boy bands slash cultural product cynically aimed at teen hyphen agers were made. The tension between art and commerce that was particularly high strung in the late 60s, so on and so forth. I will drop a link to the Paris episode in the show notes, which is very meta about how it was always the same jokes and that Peter Tork was written as though he had a traumatic brain injury as a child. It's very egregious with the filler, but also it's a ton of good songs. The French girls, like Catherine Deneuve's sister is in this shit and the fashions are really cool. There were a bunch of necklaces just on Mickey Dolenz that I'm like, come here. I just want to talk to you. I need to borrow that. And R.E.P. Mike Nesmith, he was still really cute. That little hat. Love it.
Mm-hmm.
For my plug, I will recommend Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs, in which Blankenship Chairman Mark Blankenship and I talk about corporate finance. No, we talk about songs. We are actually on hiatus for a bit because we are moving to a more seasonal format. The next full season, we will be talking about soft rock of the 70s and its legacy. But in the meantime, we have a massive archive you can enjoy, which includes last year's Ultimate Teen Idol Tournament. That was won rather handily by the Prefab Four, and there were a lot of upsets and fun discussions along the way as well. That is wherever you get your podcasts, or just go to Mark and Sarah Talk About Songs.com.
Jessica, your turn.
All right. Speaking of Paris, so Paris, France, not Hilton. Over the last several months of the pandemic, I got sucked into watching a French show. The English translation of the title is Call My Agent, which I don't know if any of you have watched, but I must recommend it very, very, very highly. It is about a film agency, and there's 4 or 5, depending on what's going on, film agents. And every episode is about problems they're having, personal problems, problems at the agency, problems with their celebrity. And there's 4 seasons. It's on Netflix. And the thing that is, first of all, it's incredibly beautifully done. It's in Paris. It's so, like, you sort of feel like you're in France because you are literally watching France. Everybody looks so chic, like it's full of beautiful coats and fantastic little boots. The offices are beautiful. So it's enjoyable visually. But the thing I found really fascinating, and I think that you guys and anyone listening to this would enjoy, is every episode, the problem child actor is an actual French actor playing themselves. And it is done in a way that is so straightforward and there's no vanity in it. And it is really fun, A, and B, really fascinating to watch it and think, no American actor would do this without being like winky about it. Like maybe one or two of them. But most people, most American actors would be like, oh, I'm being an asshole. Like they're on Entourage or something. Mm-hmm. In Call My Agent, they're playing it totally straight. And it is, it works so beautifully. There is one great episode where Isabelle Huppert is inadvertently, they screwed up and she is scheduled to film two movies simultaneously, like the wrap day of one film and the opening day of one film, they screwed up and she's scheduled on the call sheet for both. So they have to come up with, it's like a heist basically to keep her on both sets without either set realizing that she is going back and forth. Mm-hmm. And it is so charming. It is so fun to watch. It's really funny. There is a lot of interpersonal drama and like jockeying for power at the agency. So there's like some light backstabbing that's really fun. It is just like a real pleasure. I think anyone who's interested in film would enjoy it. And they get like full A-list French movie stars. It would be as if the American version would have like Brad Pitt. Like they're getting like proper stars to play themselves because it was, I guess, a real hit in France. And then it kind of became like cool to be on it. Mm-hmm. The other thing about it, so it's on Netflix. The other thing about it that's really interesting is that it has had all of these spinoffs. There's one set that I really want to watch that's set in Bollywood that I think would be amazing. Mm. I mean, it is an Indian mm-hmm. production. It's a Bollywood production.
Yeah.
And they are doing a British version. So I am going to be curious to see how the British version pans out. Helena Bonham Carter is in it playing herself. And I think that could be great or bad. I think it could go a lot of different ways. But mm-hmm. it's one of those shows where you think, this is so fun. I feel sophisticated because it's French. And also, like, it's a show where you watch it and you think, wow, the Americans are going to try this. We're going to do this. It's going to be on NBC. It's not going to be good. Like, we can't pull this off. We just are not going to be able to do
absolutely
it.
Absolutely where say it's going to be.
Yeah, as an American, like, God bless us. We can't do this. But it is so fun and chic and really interesting. And if you're someone who likes like hall or filmmaking logistics, mm-hmm. it's really interesting from that point of view as well. It really gets into like a lot of like, they have a Cannes episode that is clearly shot in Cannes and it has a lot of like Cannes logistics. There's a whole plot point. I can't remember which celebrity was, someone incredibly famous. Juliette Binoche. Doesn't like the outfit that she's meant to wear that like Chanel or whatever is sent over. So there's all this like styling shenanigans. It feels extremely true to life. So I recommend it very highly.
All right.
And my plug, Heather kind of gave them. I guess I will say that if you have someone on your Christmas list who you think might like a book about an American woman who falls in love with the British heir to the throne and has like a lot of corresponding personal problems, you should read our book, The Royal We, and its sequel, The Heir Affair. They are both in paperback and they're very long. So you also would have a lot of material to enjoy.
Yes.
All right, coming up on the Extra Hot Great Cinematic Universe on the next Extra Extra Hot Great coming this Friday, Doug S. has tasked us with imagining another show like the show Warrior that was based on a treatment by a 70s or 80s action star like Bruce Lee's treatment was made into Warrior. That is available to all supporters at any level at patreon.com/extra hot great. And then right here on the next EHG Prime, we have Tim Grierson coming in to discuss Aaron Sorkin's I Love Lucy movie, Being the Ricardos, which Tara says is one of the best movies she's ever seen.
It's something.
No Middle Ground with Tara Ariano.
Dear Mr. President, there are too many states nowadays. Please eliminate three. I am not a crackpot.
I am not a crackpot, but just about every show on Netflix is better at 1.25 speed. Action movies? The boring bits are over faster, and the action looks better when it's done faster. Dramas? Meaningful stares are just as meaningful sped up, and you get to the good parts faster. Old shows are dreadfully slow, so why not just speed them up? Are you worried about not seeing the movie the way the director really intended? This is Netflix. You're not watching Truffaut films. You're binging Seinfeld for the sixth time. The director intended for you to watch in SD on a 32-inch TV after an episode of Veronica's Closet. Moreover, watching at 1.25 speed means you'll be more engaged with the show. We all find ourselves getting distracted and second-screening shows. But if you make it go faster, you'll be more engaged with what you're actually watching. You'll spend less time looking at your phone, you'll stay off Twitter and Facebook, and that's good for everybody. Sure, you'll probably need to put subtitles on to get all the dialogue, but that's fine. It means you'll actually be looking at the screen the way Philo Farnsworth and Jesus Christ intended. Now look, I'm not crazy. Don't put on stand-up comedy at 1.25x or any other rare show that relies on pacing. If it's a show that you love, that draws you in, if you want to spend time luxuriating in this show, great, watch it however you want. But the trash you actually spend 80% of your time on Netflix watching, speed it up. This isn't just Netflix. Research has been discovering that we've been playing Beethoven too slowly for hundreds of years. Performances of Bach are now 30% faster than they were a century ago. We can process more information faster than the past, so take advantage of it. MTV didn't wreck your attention span. It gave you a superpower. You want to not pay attention to the TV and look at your phone instead? Fine. Keep your Netflix at 1.0 speed. But if you really love TV, want to engage with it, and get more of it into your eye holes? Speed it up. We all complain about the pacing in TV and movies, but now you can actually do something about it. Seize the power.
Okay. That came to us from Mr. Dan Cassino. You all know
Gorgeous.
Him.
Gorgeous.
Resident crackpot Dan Cassino. Mm-hmm. I describe this as Dan's particular brand of madness when he brought it to me, because it seemed very Dan Cassino in a way that I can't really articulate beyond, oh yeah, that's Dan Cassino just being a crazy nut bar. But what do you guys think? Is this actually, like, is this a crackpot territory, Sarah?
I don't believe it is, having just forced yet another Tiger King ancillary product into my eye holes at 1.25 speed. There are times as a reviewer when it's like, I'm not going to learn anything new about documentary filmmaking from the Doc Antle story. I've got a deadline. Let's hurry the shit up. And because Dan Cassino is a contributor to the true crime newsletter for which I write these reviews, Best Evidence, I feel like he and I are definitely on the same wavelength with some of this stuff. Research has shown that that Beethoven point was hilarious, but probably bullshit. I think he's right. Like, you don't have to do it. It's not a requirement. But, you know, everybody's busy. Shave some time off. He is not a crackpot. I agree. Wow.
Anybody else want to chime in on Sarah's incorrect opinion?
This isn't something I have done or would do. And if I found that I was, like, so eager to get through something that I wanted to watch it faster than it's supposed to go, I would just probably not watch it. I agree. Everyone is busy, but just you, that just means your bar has to get higher for what you make room for.
Yes, exactly.
In my opinion.
Well, again, as a reviewer, as a like regular civilian, it's like, if I have to speed this up to get through it, then I don't want to bother and I'll just turn it off and save the time that way. But yeah.
I feel like I know people who listen to audiobooks like at 1.5 speed to read it,
I also
faster.
So do that.
Do you? So yeah, mm-hmm. I have accidentally done this on my podcasts, and I can't, it like gives me a physical feeling, like I've never done cocaine, but I feel like I'm on cocaine and I don't like it. Like, it makes me feel, it gives me anxiety to listen to people talk faster than they're supposed to be talking. So this is counterindicated for me health-wise.
Yeah. It seems to me like something that would be professionally useful, but personally unwise. Like for me, if I'm watching something and my attitude is, I just want to get through this, then I'm watching it for the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
Does it change their voices too? Like, does it sound like they're all on helium?
Yeah. Well, it pitches it up a little bit.
Not really. I mean, pitches it up slightly. It just depends on what you're using it for. Also, I am my own grandfather, and the audiobooks that I listen to are like seriously 28-hour history shit. And it's like, look, this has got to move it along. And it's like, and then on the fourth day of 1913, like, okay, Dos Passos, chop chop.
I could definitely see where, like, I did not like Tiger King, and I feel like if I could watch that faster, if I could get that time back and have watched it in a shorter amount of time,
little condensed,
I would do
that.
Like, I sympathize when you're a critic and you're like, I've gotten what I need for my review. It would be irresponsible not to finish this, but it's not going to affect my opinion. Let's move
exactly.
I feel like that is the less crackpotty side of this mm-hmm. argument.
But yeah, selective deployment, I would say. Mm-hmm.
It is time for the extra hot great canon. Submitting this week is user Laura. Take it away, Laura.
Thank you for considering Season 5, Episode 12 of The X-Files, Bad Blood, for submission into the Extra Hot Great canon. With 6 episodes already in the canon, X-Files is well established as a canon-worthy show. One also then has to ask, with 6 episodes already in the canon, what makes this episode noteworthy? Today, I'm going to outline 6 reasons why I believe this episode should be submitted into the canon. Reason number 1. This is a classic example of an X-Files Monster of the Week style show. It's creepy, it involves vampires, a classic monster, and right from the beginning, we're drawn in. We're in Chandler, Texas, under a full moon. There's a kid running, being chased through the woods, running for his life. His pursuer catches him and impales him through the heart with a wooden stake. The camera pulls back to reveal that Mulder was the assailant. Reason number 2 is that even though the theme is familiar with a Monster of the Week, it's filled with tons of surprises, with tons of familiar names and faces. The writer is Vince Gilligan, the future creator of Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. The denim-wearing, assumed to be vampire, is that kid from The Sandlot, a.k.a. Patrick Wren. And the sheriff is played by Luke Wilson. Reason number 3. The very basis of the X-Files is the dichotomy of Mulder as a believer and Scully as a skeptic, and the natural push and pull of these perspectives. This episode ups the ante on this tension by recalling the same events, first told by Scully, and then as told by Mulder. This is set up in clip 1.
What are you going to tell him?
What do you mean, what am I going to tell him? I'm going to tell him exactly what I saw. What are you going to tell him?
I'll tell him exactly what I saw.
How is that different?
And now, on to the 4th reason why I believe this episode is canon-worthy. This episode is funny. There are lots of jokes interspersed throughout, whether it's Mulder referring to Large Marge as Scully's future cellmate, or earnestly using the phrase classic vampirism. There's some of the dark humor typical of the X-Files, like when Scully orders a pizza after being inspired by the toppings in an autopsy subject's stomach. But the real humor in this comes from the comparison between the differences of Scully's story and Mulder's story. For example, here's how Scully said the day began.
Yesterday morning, when I arrived at work, you were characteristically exuberant.
Hope you brought your cowboy boots.
You want us to go to Dallas?
Yeehaw! Actually, a town called Cheney, about 50 miles south of there, population 361. By all accounts, very rustic and charming, but as of late, ground zero, the locus for a series of mysterious nocturnal exsanguinations.
Exsanguinations? Of whom?
How does that grab you?
Now, compare this with Fox's retelling in clip 3.
Yesterday morning began like any other morning. You arrived at the office characteristically less than exuberant. I hope you brought your cowboy boots.
Why are we going to Dallas?
It's a little town just south of there called Cheney, Texas. They've had some incidents down there recently, which I think you'll agree are pretty unusual.
Like what?
Well, I brought some slides with which to better illustrate. Here we go.
It's a dead cow.
It's actually 6 dead cows, and here's the really interesting thing.
Why am I looking at 6 dead cows?
Well, because of the manner in which they died, all 6 were mysteriously exsanguinated.
By far the best running gag at this duel of interpretations is the differing accounts of Luke Wilson as the sheriff, best highlighted by contrasting Scully's account of meeting the sheriff in clip 4 with Fox's account of the same meeting in clip 5.
It was there that we were met by a representative of local law enforcement. Sheriff.
Lucius Horwell. You the FBI agents?
Yes, I'm...
Agents Mulder and, Scully. What do you say we go take a look at your victim? Yeah, by all means. After you. Scully, get those little legs moving. Come on.
The obviously fake teeth Luke is wearing in Fox's account never ceases to amuse me.
Apparently your mind was somewhere else.
Ooh, boy.
Y'all must be the government people. I'm Lucius Harwell.
Lots of X-Files episodes have funny moments, but this episode goes full goofy. First, let's listen to clip 6.
Well, luckily I'd gotten there in time. I mean, though you were drugged, you were more or less unharmed. Mulder, are you okay?
Who's the black private dick who's a sex machine with all the chicks?
Shaft!
Can you dig it? They say this cat Shaft is a bad mother. Shut your mouth. Talking about Shaft.
I did not.
In this clip, we get a glance at how goofy and childish Scully sees Fox to be. But even probably more importantly, we get TV's greatest acting robot singing the theme to Shaft. A bit later in the episode, we get evidence that might validate Scully's perspective on Fox when the sheriff and Fox attempt to control a runaway RV.
What do you think? We ought to shoot the tires out?
Anyway, skipping ahead.
Why skip ahead? What happened then? Mulder, you shot out the tires, and what then?
Okay, here's something you may not know. Shooting out the tires on a runaway RV is a lot harder than it looks. I then tried a different approach.
The runaway RV in this scene is like a foreshadowing of what was to come with Breaking Bad. And now we move to reason 5. This episode is canon worthy. The Vince Gilligan of it all. The dual perspectives, letting the viewer piece the information as stories come together. It keeps the viewer changing their perspective on what is the truth. There are vampires. There are no vampires. Or maybe there are. The twisting storylines keep the viewer so unsure and unsteady that they're even able to pull the classic trick from The Lost Boys that the most powerful vampire has been hiding in plain sight all along. The writing is giving us an idea of what is going to come. It's Vince Gilligan practicing keeping the audience an active participant, a little unsteady, but thinking they might be a step ahead of the characters. And now, on to my 6th and final reason why this episode is canon worthy. The takeaway from this episode makes clear a theme of the series. Scully and Mulder are equal contributors, and the puzzle cannot be complete without both of their perspectives. Scully served as a very important role model for a lot of young girls growing up. This was an era where Kelly Bundy was on TV, and Scully was in the FBI as a physician holding her own against a very charismatic and powerful man. So, for these 6 reasons, I hope you see fit to induct Season 5, Episode 12 of The X-Files, titled Bad Blood, into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Thank you, Laura. Heather and Jessica, our guests, picked this in part because Jessica was, as we've already alluded to, the X-Files recapper at our old website, Television Without Pity. So, Jessica, please start us off.
I am happy to start you off. As mentioned, I did recap X-Files for Mighty Big TV / TWAP. And this is a Season 5 episode. And I think I can't remember when I started recapping. Season 9?
Yeah, it was later because I don't think the site existed when this was on. Yeah.
Yes, it was when Mulder had gone to the store and never come back. But during the summer, I would recap like classic episodes for fun. And this, in fact, is one that I recapped because, drumroll, this is my very favorite X-Files episode of all time. So yes, I'm surprised it's not already in the canon. So when I saw it on the list, I was like, bingo. I don't even have to rewatch that one, although I did, but I wouldn't have had to because I remember it extremely well. I've seen it many times. And also, you know, when you recap something, you're like,
yeah,
I got to transcribe this whole thing. And yeah, I mean, I love this episode. It's so funny. And I remember when it aired originally, it really was for me and my friends, like, kind of a water cooler episode. Like the next day we really did tell each other, like, did you watch X-Files last night? It was so funny. Like, I remember driving to work in my very shitty car from my like crappy apartment at the time and thinking about the scene where Mulder sings the Shaft theme song and like how funny I thought it was. Mm-hmm. I've never forgotten that. So yeah, I mean, I love this episode. I think it's really well acted. I think it is constantly funny to me to see the way that each of Mulder and Scully like present themselves to each other.
Yes.
I think the Scully one is great. And I think Gillian Anderson, her hair, this is also at a period of time in my life when I was like very into that hair and wanted it on my own head. Mm-hmm. So she's great, obviously. But I think the way Mulder presents his side of the story, where he's just like this gentle, reasonable human being who's like,
he's actually so meek with her.
And she's just like rolling over him. It just never stops being funny to me. Yeah. And, you know, especially for an episode where you don't get a lot of like the other regular characters, like Skinner pops up for like a minute to be like, come in and talk to me. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of it. Although you do see Skinner's secretary who looks just like Scully, which was always sort of funny to me. They really are off in their own world for this one, which I think is, you know, kind of not unusual, but like it really is just about the two of them. I just think it is a great, I already said it's my favorite episode. Like I love this episode. And I also agree, as she wisely brought up in the canon, I've often thought that one of the reasons Breaking Bad is so good is because Vince Gilligan was on X-Files, which famously did not have a show Bible. And you mm-hmm. can tell at the end where they forgot stuff and like random shit happens. And you're like, well, you already told us 2 years ago that XYZ happened. Now you forgot that. Like it really just like devolved. And I always like to think about Vince Gilligan, like living through that and thinking, when it's my show, this shit's not going to happen.
Yeah,
and it locked the fuck down.
Mm-hmm. I have got this shit planned out. So yeah, I just think this episode is just a delight. And however old it is, I think it has remained sort of like fresh and very clever.
All right, Heather.
Yeah, I mean, I'm coming at this from completely the opposite perspective as Jess. It's interesting that, you know, we talked about the Sex and the City reboot, or not reboot, sequel, I guess. And we're talking about this. And these are shows I did not watch as much of when they were originally on. So I came to this with very little experience with the X-Files and really enjoyed it. I think even just looking at it, as an episode, as a crafted episode of TV, you think nowadays it's so common to do stuff like you jump in the middle of the episode and then they're like 48 hours earlier. Mm-hmm. Or like any of those other little
Dave's
gimmicks.
Dave's favorite thing besides Joel
Kinnaman.
And you
look at this and you're like, this was a 97, 98 season, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was probably before all those other shows. Like you can see where this might have been a template that gave other showrunners the ideas to sort of play with time and space a little bit differently. I really liked the presenter's way of phrasing it that, yes, it's really funny that you're seeing, you know, Scully presenting, she's just this sort of gentle, I just care about the work, and Mulder's being really aggravating and vague. And then you see his point of view. Yes, that's funny, but that it does make an argument that you need both of their perspectives, and that's why they're a good team. And I think season 5 is a really smart time in a show's life cycle to have that episode, because you've been here together for a while. And as I was going through my streaming service, I was like, oh, hot damn, they did like 24 episodes a season. So mm-hmm. they'd done a lot of TV at this point. And it is kind of nice to hit that button that lets you say, okay, this is why these people still work together.
Yeah.
Yes, she sees him this way sometimes and he sees her this way sometimes, but it's the average of the two, which is what we're seeing every other week, that makes their partnership work. Like you need both sides. And I thought this episode did that in a way that wasn't heavy-handed or anything. Like it actually, you sort of laughed along with it and you were like, oh, those two, I can't wait to see what they're back up to next week. But it also in a way that sends itself up lovingly. Mm-hmm. Like the X-Files has a sense of humor about itself and it shines through very, very nicely in this hour. I did also write down, they both look great. Everyone is hot, which is important.
That was one of the main through lines of the whole series, Heather. Mm-hmm. Is these two hot people, will they bang? ? Mm-hmm. Come over to the X-Files board.
Yeah. But it was interesting because I did then go back and watch the pilot and I was like, oh yeah, no, her hair in Bad Blood was Jesus. She really, mm-hmm. she had that worked out. So yeah, I really enjoyed it. And I did laugh out loud when our presenter referred to Duchovny as TV's greatest acting robot.
Yes. Mm-hmm. We've called him that on the podcast many times. It's a Futurama line.
I was all of history's great acting robots. Acting unit 0.8, Thespomat, David Duchovny.
There it is.
Another show I'm not as familiar with, but what a wonderful callback to your history as well.
Sarah, you have previously presented an X-Files episode to the canon. Why don't you go next?
I did not recall this episode, like, right offhand looking at the title. And then the minute it started, I was like, oh, right.
Same.
The kid from the Sandlot. There are a few things that are a little bit clattery about this. But first of all, this is a longer runtime than you kids are used to. Like, remember when dramas were like 46 minutes long? You don't feel any of it in your butt. You don't have to watch this at 1.25, Dan Casino. It was pleasurable. It moved right along and was very confident in its own structure, which I think is a Gilligan hallmark. Another one is that you really get an excellent sort of atmospheric shorthanded sense of these characters' fondness for each other, as well as the show's fondness for them and their relationship. And even Skinner is like not as big of a twat as he usually is in this episode, perhaps because he's barely in it. But like usually he just acts like he has several kidney stones like lined up in the chamber. Yes. And that is much less this time. There are a couple of moments where I'm like, this is a little too funny for Scully, given that this is her telling of it. But it's also like, okay, like that, I don't care. Like the line delivery is perfect. Like Gillian Anderson always understands like where she's supposed to be in the limbic system of this universe. Like mm-hmm. whether it's a Monster of the Week episode, whether there's a ton of blue gels and she's supposed to be super serious and pregnant. Like she always knows what she's supposed to do. Duchovny is great in this. His extremely book reportish version of his presentation and his version is hilarious. But then when he's like, get those little legs moving, I'm like, why are you alive? But that's just such a good, there's so many little subtle ways in which this portrait and then the sort of side-by-side portraits by each of them are painted. And Luke Wilson, I think, is an underrated performer, frankly,
very.
In that family and generally. And that moment when you have the turn where he's like, he doesn't understand the concept of a low profile. And I was like, oh, yeah. Oh, shit. And then like Poochie goes back to his home planeted the ending. But like that was the only option. And they did it very elegantly. And the shot was beautiful. This is just a well-constructed, confident, authoritative, and also warm and fond episode of TV that, given that it's genre, sci-fi, like that's not easy to do. And it's, you know, Vince Gilligan, thank you for existing. I actually quote him all the time. He is a genius. This was a great presentation. I think it hit all the right notes. And this was really a pleasure to be reminded of not just this particular episode, but everything else that the show could be at its peak. And how well-seated it was in itself and its own mythos before, you know, nuts and bolts started flying off the off the thing. And also, like, a runaway vehicle bit. Like, you got to be careful. You only get one, like, per show. And it's well done. Very well done.
I'll go next. I don't have a ton to add. It is funny to be talking about this the same week that I was talking about live in front of a studio audience, because a lot of the same things come into play where it's not just the joke of seeing the differences between Scully's Rashomon recollections and Mulder's, which, by the way, when Laura kept calling him Fox, I was like, who? Oh, right.
Me too.
But it's also watching like the actors get to stretch and like do what their goofy version of like the their opposite numbers impression of them. So like seeing them have fun like this is a joy. And there's a reason that we, you know, for canon purposes, Monster of the Week episodes work better. But like, you know, as Sarah said and Jessica said, like in terms of the lack of a show Bible, like the myth arc, I think we could all agree, did not totally work. But these, I mean, most of the time, these hit, like, they still hit so hard. And especially for this to be in, as Heather said, season five, when they'd done dozens of episodes by now, it's like they know each other, the writers know them, they know what they can do, they know how they can push them. And, you know, the framing story is so slight because it's just such a great showcase for the performances. And Luke Wilson is great. And it's also funny that he looks so much like David Duchovny, too. He's like the heartthrob.
That's true.
That's true.
Yeah. I thought that at the time. It was funny that it didn't come up until now. But they look alike to me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Anyway, this was great. It was fun to watch it again. I was so happy that this was the one because I didn't make the it's not my favorite episode, but I did enjoy it and I didn't remember what it was as Sarah and as at the same time that Sarah did. So yeah, great. Great work. Dave.
For me, this episode is sort of highlights why X-Files succeeded where all the ones that tried to be X-Files failed. Because like here's a show that can be conspiratorial, one episode, funny, sexy, scary, dumb, but it all lives under one roof, like harmoniously.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas like all the other shows that followed it, Millennium, Harsh Realm, Freaky Links, ones that were like, let's be X-Files, but let's just be this one part of the X-Files that I particularly enjoy. Not realizing that is more than the sum of its parts.
And it's never the funny part, P.S.
It's never the funny part. Ever. Yeah. It's always like, oh, it's the dark brooding version of the X-Files, or it's the super nerdy version of the X-Files. And it just never hits the same way. And this episode sort of exemplifies how malleable the X-Files was and why it was such a broad hit, considering that the tagline, the log lines usually, dude thinks aliens are messing with Earth. Like that as a like show nutshell, it's like, I don't want to watch that. But then it's like, it's so much more. It's like got something for everybody, right? It's like it's a big tent alien conspiracy show, if ever there was one. And this episode just really highlights how well crafted it could be at times. And I don't think it's a mistake that most of the episodes in the canon are the Monster of the Week episodes.
Yeah.
And those are the ones that stand up
because
those are the ones that gave him the most freedom to do. It's X-Files, but it's also this, right? It's the genesis of the X-Files, but it's kind of funny. It's the genesis of the X-Files, but we're going to play around with time, or we're going to play around with, you know, this Rashomon sort of effect. And it just is a show that nobody has quite been able to reproduce in the same way, even though I believe like the subject matter is still something everybody wants to mine.
Right? Yeah.
The only thing about this episode that I kind of never figured out by the end, and the answer is probably you don't need to figure it out, but I never really understood the relevance of the fake teeth that the Sandlot guy
had. I think
had.
You get a lot of background from Mulder being like, a lot of the things that we understand as, you know, classic vampire aspects are really not. So like when someone has that line about like, they both watched a lot of vampire movies and are vampires, I think that's what you're supposed to.
So it's real, but it's just a guy overacting. Is that kind of
yes?
Like, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Feels like the show itself. It's like is the truth is out there, but like sometimes like you've got the Scully side of it, which is there's an explanation for everything, and then you have the Mulder side of it, where they're it could just be that they're vampires, and like, it's almost like they found a way for that to coexist.
This also like came up in the most recent season of American Horror Story, where like people were turned into vampires, and then I mean, mild spoiler. They have to go to someone to get their teeth filed down and then get caps put on them because they still want to eat blood, but they don't automatically get the fangs. So maybe that's the case here as well.
Okay. Vampire logistics. I want a show about that.
Mm-hmm. Vampire dentist.
DDS. Dr. Fang, DDS.
Dr. Fang.
And I also just, again, whenever I come across a really good line, I'm always like, my mind transports me to the writer's room and how long they took to figure out that government was the absolute best word to start off Bucktooth Luke Wilson sheriff character.
Mm-hmm. Because I laugh every time he shows up in Mulder's version, and it's just like,
it's really good.
He so commits to it. It's just hilarious.
If you have no or low opinion of Luke Wilson, watch this episode and it will raise it for sure.
Mm-hmm.
He's
yeah.
super good sport for doing this. Really enjoyed it. Great presentation. Great episode. Let's put this to the official vote. Jessica Morgan, what say you?
I say yay. Yes.
Heather.
I say yay.
Sarah.
Ancient alien experts say yes.
And Tara.
Me as well.
Yeah, that's going to be 5 for 5. I think that might be a record. I think it might be the most votes for one single canon episode. All right, that means the X-Files Season 5, Episode 12, Bad Blood, you are hereby inducted into the extra hot gray canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It is time to discover the winner and the loser of the week. Tara has this week's winner.
Well, when we had Danny McEachern on a few weeks ago, he was talking about Yellowstone and how it is the show that is a huge hit and despite being completely devoid of buzz somehow. And what you may not know, first of all, is that there's a show called Yellowstone. Second of all, it's getting a prequel series called 1883, which is set in that year, I believe. And it was just announced this week that one of the guest stars on this fucking thing is going to be Tom Hanks, as in that Tom Hanks, playing Civil War General. Last name is Meade. Now I got to look it up. George Meade. And there's a photo on this Collider report of him in costume, in character. And I don't know where they are spending their money on this thing, but it's not on beards because he looks like he's in a school play. Like, this is some real amateur hour shit. But I can't believe they got Tom Hanks. Like, he doesn't do TV. It's not even like it's Apple TV, where apparently all of his movies go now, Finch. But
is it like his production company or something behind it?
Maybe.
Yeah.
Anyway, congratulations to 1883. Because Tom Hanks, pretty big get.
All right.
Seriously.
I would say if I got to watch any show at 1.25 speed, it's probably going to be Yellowstone. We tried to watch the first one, didn't we?
I tried to watch it. I don't think you were even there, and I didn't get through the pilot.
Who is our loser of the week?
That is Jussie Smollett, found guilty on 5 of 6 charges related to his faking an assault on himself in 2019. And also, by proxy, the Cook County court system. Like, I kind of can't believe this got all the way to trial, never mind to a jury decision. Never mind that the jury was like, justice is served. Like, really? Like, we're actually still treating with this? Okay. But yes, guilty on 5 of 6 of those charges. Like, how are they even 6 charges? What are we doing here?
Speak about often getting only 5 of 6 things. Do you know what time it is?
Is it game time?
Is it, Tara?
It's non-regulation game time, so I don't know why you did the segue, but God bless.
Use the fuck out of me, I guess.
We had a very busy week here at HQ, so Dave is cashing in one of the non-regulation game times he has won in a previous non-regulation game time, and I am supplying the game this week. Let me walk you through it. As we all know, Sex and the City required a steady supply of guest stars to come through and, not to put too fine a point on it, fuck the ladies. Oftentimes, a guest star who broke out on Sex and the City would go on to be a series regular elsewhere. For example, Justin Theroux has gone on to The Mosquito Coast, Mark Feuerstein to Royal Pains, Timothy Olyphant to Justified, and so on. This fact has inspired today's non-regulation game time, The Sexinest City. Talk about New York City, baby! I will give you the name of a guest star who appeared on a TV show set in New York as a love interest to one of the series regulars. And then another TV character that actor went on to play as a series regular on another show. So, for example, if I said, after playing Liz Lemon's love interest, Floyd DeBarber on 30 Rock, he went on to play Ted Lasso on this show, you would know I'm looking for the actor.
Jason Sudeikis.
Jason Sudeikis.
And the star of...
Which
Ted
show?
Lasso?
Yes. If you need a hint, you can ask for either the actor's name or the name of the later show where there was series regular. And if you can figure out the missing info after that, it's worth 1 point. Get 2 points for the full boat. Standard stakes for a non-regulation game time. If Dave wins, he gets 3 steel meals to distribute as he wishes, plus the right to make me write another non-regulation game time in the future. And if Sarah, Heather, or Jessica wins, they get 3 steel meals, plus the right to make me watch something for a future around the dial. Got 32 questions and a tiebreaker. Let us throw to Picky to see who goes first.
We will start with Sarah.
We will start with Sarah. And our order will be Sarah, Dave, Jessica, Heather. Are you ready to play The Sexinest City?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Sarah D. Bunting. After playing Monica's love interest, Richard Burke, on Friends, he went on to play Frank Reagan on this show.
Oh, God. I'm my own grandfather, like I said, which is why I know that this is Tom Selleck on Blue Bloods.
That is correct for 2 points. Dave.
Mm-hmm.
After playing Leela's love interest, Chaz, on Futurama, he went on to play Jimmy McGill on this show.
Oh, okay. So that is... Bob Odenkirk on Better Call Saul.
That is correct for 2 points.
I did not know that was him.
Yep, it's an uncredited role, but I looked it up. Jessica. After playing Daniel's love interest, Grace Chin, on Ugly Betty, she went on to play Watson on this show.
Okay, I recapped Ugly Betty, and I don't remember this at all.
You can ask for a hint.
I need a hint.
But wait, before you ask for the hint, she played Watson.
She did play Watson.
Oh, who is Lucy Liu on Elementary?
That's right.
You're
in
welcome.
The form of a question.
Oh, my God.
Recent Jeopardy star, Jessica.
Jesus, right? I did not win. And now you know why.
Oh, boy.
Heather. After playing Dan's love interest, Olivia Burke, the second and, by the way, not last Burke of this game. After playing Olivia Burke on Gossip Girl, the original one, she went on to play Kelsey Peters on this show.
It's Hilary Duff on Younger.
That's correct for 2 points. Back to Sarah. After playing Ted's love interest, Cindy, on How I Met Your Mother, she went on to play Dr. Zoe Hart on this show.
That's Rachel Bilson on... God, why? I watched the show. I remember the leather shorts. It's not Heart to Heart. It's not Deep in the Heart of Texas. It's Clear Hearts, Full Hearts Can't Lose. I don't remember the name of the show.
Steel Meal.
You're going to steel meal on a non-regulation game time?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, what am I also going to use my steel
meal? I don't know.
Do I get a point for Bilson or no?
You get a point for Bilson. Yes, that's okay. Correct.
Heart of Dixie.
Heart of Dixie is
Heart
correct.
Heart of Dixie. Good job, Dave.
Okay, back to Dave for your actual question. Yes. After playing Frank's love interest, Lynn Onkman, on 30 Rock, she went on to play Betty Davis on this show.
Oh, okay. Susan Sarandon on Feud?
Feud is correct. Okay. All right. To Jessica.
Okay.
After playing Jerry's love interest, Meryl, on Seinfeld, she went on to play Monica on this show.
Courtney Cox on Friends.
That's correct for 2 points.
All right.
Heather. After playing Rose's love interest, Marcus, on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, he went on to play himself as host of this show.
Oh, God. Thanks.
You can ask for a hint.
It's tricky because... It was him playing himself as the host of a show.
Well, he's a host of a show.
He's a host of a show.
Yes.
So the hint would be his name, therefore the answer?
His name might not be in the title of the show. It depends on who it is.
Mm-hmm.
Rose's love interest, Marcus. I guess I should try to get a point. So maybe I'll go with the act. Do I get to pick which one you give me or you're picking? I guess I'll go with the actor's name.
Nick Cannon.
What
did he host, though? He hosted a couple things. He's hosted America's Got Talent, and hasn't he also hosted The Masked Singer?
The Masked Singer was what I was looking for, but yes, you're right.
Okay.
So, 1 point.
Great. Phew.
I don't feel like that was a definitive answer, but Tara is very generous.
Well, it's a non-regulation game, Doug. Sarah.
Yes.
After playing Elena's love interest, Tracy, on Felicity, he went on to play Chris Turk on this show.
Is Donald Faison on Scrubs.
That is correct for 2 points. Dave.
Yeah.
A Scrubs question I got.
Yeah.
Nice.
Okay.
History has been
Knowledge 5.
Dave.
That's a Scrubs joke. Yeah, I didn't.
After playing Beth's love interest, Theo, on News Radio, he went on to play Tobias Funke on this show.
Okay, so that's David Cross and Arrested Development.
Correct. Jessica.
I don't
know. Yes.
After playing Serena's love interest, Trip Vanderbilt, on Gossip Girl, the original again, he went on to play Danny Bailey in this show.
Okay. Is it Aaron Trivette?
That's Danny close enough.
Right, this is a name I've never said. Danny Bailey.
Tveit,
sure.
I think so.
That sounds true.
Sounds like Danny you're doing Bailey. Latin verbs.
Anyway, that's good right. for 1 point.
All right, so I got that one.
Yep.
Danny Bailey, I don't know. I'm going to make an educated guess. What sort of show would he have been in?
Mm.
The Newsroom?
No.
It's a good guess, though.
It is a good guess, but in fact, it is Schmigadoon.
Oh, I didn't watch that.
Okay.
Back to Heather. After playing Noel's love interest, Hannah, on Felicity, she went on to play Sydney Bristow on this show.
Jennifer Garner on Alias.
Correct for 2 points. Sarah, after playing Alana's love interest, Adele, on Broad City, she went on to play Dory Seif on this show.
Can you say that again?
After playing Alana's love interest, Adele, on Broad City, she went on to play Dory Seif, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, S-I-E-F, on this show.
It's the show is Surge Party.
Correct.
And the actor is maybe Funky. Shit. Help. Help me. It's not Dory Shafir. damn it. I don't know. I'm going to kill myself, but I don't know.
Alia Shawkat.
Of course.
All right.
Damn it. Dave.
Yeah.
After playing Ted's love interest, Tracy McConnell, on How I Met Your Mother, she went on to play Hazel Green in this show.
Oh, boy. Okay, wait. Okay, once more, please.
After playing Ted's love interest, Tracy McConnell, on How I Met Your Mother, she went on to play Hazel Green in this show.
Hazel Green. Oh, okay. Ooh. Okay, is that Kristen...
If you get close, I'll give it to you like I did with Yvette or whatever.
Melody?
That's pretty close.
Melody?
You're picturing the right person. That's correct. Yes. Okay. Kristen Milioti.
Milioti. Okay. Mm-hmm. And it was Rachel. No, Hazel.
Hazel Green.
Hazel Green. It doesn't ring a bell, but it's a New York.
No, How I Met Your Mother is the New York.
Oh, New York. Oh, right. Okay. So Hazel. What show was she a Hazel in?
I can picture the poster, and I can't pull the name either.
Yeah, I don't know this one either.
Okay, so... Is it the show that I can't remember the title for?
Yeah, seems like it.
Yeah.
Okay, nice. I don't know what it is. I'm just going to guess, just so I have it out there, not for points, obviously, because I can't remember the title.
Uh-huh.
But is it the Netflix show where she's like got the brain thing?
It's not Netflix. It was HBO Max, but yes.
It is that show, For yes. Love or whatever.
Made for Love.
Made for Love. Damn it.
Oh.
That show we watched. But anyway, you still get 1 point for Kristen Milioti.
All right, I'll take that.
Back to Jessica.
Yes.
After playing Hannah's love interest, Chuck Palmer, on Girls, he went on to play Perry Mason on this show. I forgot this question was in the game.
Okay, it's Matthew Rhys on Perry Mason.
Correct.
I forgot he was on Girls.
Oh my God, so did I, and I'm not happy to be revisiting that information.
Yeah, one of the few I've watched. All right, Heather, after playing Grace's love interest, Mark, on Will and Grace, he went on to play Ron Donald on this show.
Oh, geez. Will and Grace, I'm assuming, is the first. I can't. Grace's love interest, Mark.
Mm-hmm. On Will and Grace. And then he played Ron Donald on this show. You can ask for a hint.
Oh, I'm going to have to, obviously.
You want the actor or the show?
Yeah. I can't think of... I'm going to go for the show name for this one, for the hint.
That's a good hint. The show is Party Down.
Well, that was a mistake.
We've all been there.
I haven't seen that either.
Okay.
The only actor I can think of who's on that show, I don't think could possibly have been Grace Adler's love interest. Assuming it's Will or Grace. But whatever, I'm just going to say his name. Adam Scott.
That's not correct.
That's
who else is on it?
Does anyone else know?
I mean, I know who was on Party Down, but I have no idea.
Ken Marino.
Oh, right.
I mean, I knew it wasn't Adam Scott because that seemed impossible, but I just...
Yeah, I wouldn't have gotten that either.
Halfway through the game. Let's get a score break, Sarah.
All right. Heather has 5. I have 6. Jessica has 7. And David T. Cole is in the lead with 8. So it is a very close game. Anyone could still take it home.
Good job, everybody. Back to Sarah. After playing Dave's love interest, Foxy Jackson, on News Radio, she went on to play Elizabeth Burke on this show.
Elizabeth Burke?
Mm-hmm.
Can I hear the first part again, please?
After playing Dave's love interest, Foxy Jackson, on News Radio, she went on to play Elizabeth Burke on this show.
Oh, it's
there it is.
It's Tiffany Thiessen,
correct?
And you know the show White Collar. Jesus,
yes,
good one.
R.I.P. Mozzie, by the way.
Oh, I know.
Yeah, we didn't talk about that. I knew you knew this one because we watched the Foxy Jackson episode.
Yes,
and
I was like, what?
Yes. All right, back to Dave.
Yeah.
After playing Peggy's love interest, Michael Ginsburg, on Mad Men, he went on to play Jonah Sims on this show.
Oh, shit. Okay, so the show's Superstore.
That's correct.
And the actor is...
He feels bad for you, I'm going to tell you that right now. You don't think about him at all.
Yeah. Sorry, say it once more to jog my memory, because when you said that, everything in my brain disappeared.
Okay, I'll read the whole thing again. Yeah, after playing Peggy's love interest,
Ben
Michael
Feldman.
Ginsburg. What?
Ben Feldman.
Ben Feldman is correct.
Well done.
Good for 2 points. Jessica. After playing Maxine's love interest, Brendan, on Living Single, he went on to play Lucius Lyon on this show.
Okay, so Empire.
Correct.
Is it Terrence Howard?
Yes.
No. Okay, good. Phew.
Nice.
Heather. After playing Spence's love interest, Jenny, on The King of Queens, she went on to play Quinn King on this show.
I'm going to go for the whole banana. Is it Constance Zimmer on Unreal?
Yes!
Oh!
Nicely done.
Well, wow.
The whole banana.
That was impressive.
Very good.
Thank you.
All right, back to Sarah. After playing Khadijah's love interest, Terrence Scooter Williams on Living Single, he went on to play Jefferson Pierce on this show.
Jefferson Pierce?
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson Pierce. Is the show Scandal?
No.
Then I don't know who this is.
Okay. That's Cress Williams in Black Lightning.
Oh, oh no.
Mayor LaVon Hayes.
Deshaun.
I knew you watched.
Sorry.
I picked it.
Oh. You owe him a
I
Texas
did,
dip.
But I watched like season one. And,
All right, back to Dave.
Yeah.
After playing Karen's love interest, Nick, on Will and Grace, he went on to play Ron Swanson on this show.
Oh, okay. It's Nick Offerman on Parks and Rec.
That's correct.
What was his name on Will and Grace?
Nick.
Oh,
before he was anyone.
Easy.
I think he was just...
Was he a woodworker?
Megan Mullally's. He was a handyman in
that
episode.
Of course he was, yeah.
Aww. That sounds right.
Jessica.
Yes.
After playing Joey's and Ross's love interest, Charlie Wheeler, on Friends, she went on to play Lana Kane on this show.
Oh, God. When you said Joey went to Potter, and it got me totally off track.
No, Joey and Ross on Friends.
Yes, no. Once you said Ross, I realized we were not in Dawson's Creek anymore. Could you read me the beginning of it again?
I'll read the whole thing. After playing Joey's and Ross's love interest, Charlie Wheeler, on Friends, she went on to play Lana Kane on this show.
Oh, God. I'm going to miss this one, and I'm going to hear about it. Can I get the show?
Sure. The show is Archer.
Oh, yeah. No, I don't know this at all. I have no idea who played a love interest on Friends. I remember this episode and I can't. I'm like just blanking on the actor. I totally remember this plot line. I don't know. I'm out.
See you now.
Okay.
Aisha Tyler.
Aisha Tyler is correct.
Oh, of course. Sorry, Aisha.
She's fine. We got another Will and Grace one for Heather. After playing Grace's love interest, Sam Truman, on Will and Grace, he went on to play Roger Sterling on this show.
Okay. Well, that I can do. So that's John Slattery on Mad Men.
Correct.
There you go.
Also a past Sex and City guest star.
I was just going to say.
Mm-hmm. coming back around to Sarah D. Bunting. After playing Jerry's love interest, Beth Luckner, on Seinfeld, she went on to play Grace on this show.
Really? Wow. Mm-hmm. Is it Deborah Messing on Will and Grace?
Yes.
Phew.
Dave.
Yeah.
After playing Rose's love interest, Adrian Pimento, on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, he went on to play Jay on this show.
Okay, so that's Jason Mazukas.
Yes.
Mazukas on, sorry, what was the character?
Jay.
On Big Mouth.
Correct, for 2 points. Jessica.
Yes.
After playing Jerry's love interest, Valerie, on Seinfeld, she went on to play Lorelai Gilmore on this show.
Lauren Graham on Gilmore Girls.
Good for 2 points.
Nice.
Heather. After playing Jack's love interest, Celeste Cunningham, on 30 Rock, she went on to play Hillary Clinton on this show.
Oh. Yeah. Is that a recent show I should have watched and didn't?
It's recent. I'll give you that.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if I'm going to be able to remember who this was.
You can ask for
a hint.
Or
what the name of that was. It was a thing that happened that involved other people who are not the names I'm coming up with.
This is pro-stalling, for what it's worth.
Thank you.
Do you want a hint? Because you can have one.
I'm going to need a hint, and I'm just trying to figure out if I don't think I'm going to be able to get... I keep wanting to say a word that isn't a thing. Oh, yeah, give me the actress's name.
Edie Falco.
Never would have gotten it, so glad I didn't.
All right.
And I'm going to say it was... Impeachment?
You got it!
I kept wanting to say American Horror Story Insurrection. Like, that's not a thing yet.
I'm early with that one. She can come back for that.
All right.
I have to be very careful with my I word.
You each have one question left. Sarah D. Bunting, where are our scores?
Okay. Heather and I are dutifully bringing up the rear with 10 points each. Jessica has 11. David T. Cole has 15 points.
Oh, my.
David T. Cole is killing it.
Okay.
I love New York, and I love relationships. I love love.
Here are all of your last questions. Sarah.
Yes.
After playing Phoebe's love interest, Mike Hannigan, on Friends, he went on to play Dr. Ike Hirschkopf on this show.
The show is The Shrink Next Door.
Correct.
And he is Paul Rudd.
That's correct.
My God, I could not come up with the name Paul Rudd, and I was like, am I having a fucking stroke right now?
Your brain is throwing trays around the cafeteria.
And the way you said he is Paul Rudd, it's like you were pitching an autobiography to him in his office.
And he is.
And it will be called Paul Rudd.
Dave, your last question.
Okay. Whew.
After playing Pete's love interest, Trudy Campbell, on Mad Men, she went on to play Ruth Wilder on this show.
Oh, okay. Really? Pete? Sorry, one more time?
After playing Pete's love interest, Trudy Campbell, on Mad Men.
Yeah, Mad Men. Okay.
She went on to play Ruth Wilder.
Okay, this is why I was confused. I heard Pete and I blanked out because I immediately was thinking, oh, Pete from 30 Rock, because he has so many 30 Rock questions. And I was trying to figure out when the actress's name, whose name I forget. shit.
All right, well, what's the show?
Wait. Read the whole... now I'm in my own head. One more time, please.
After playing Pete's love interest, Trudy Campbell, on Mad Men...
Yes.
She went on to play Ruth Wilder on this show.
Okay, that is from Glow.
Correct.
One point. The actress's name is... Yep. Something Brie. Give me a moment. Allison Brie?
Yeah.
Okay. Wow. We've got some journeys in this last round.
We really got there, though.
Okay, nice but I'm really bad with celebrity names, so it takes me a little while process them and eliminate people I was thinking of.
He always likes second great. Game time, and he always wins non-regulation
My brain
game
was
time,
going
so
to the Alice from the Star Trek reboot.
Oh.
Alice. Yeah. You know what I'm talking
about?
Oh,
yeah. Okay. Uh-huh.
It's let's have somebody in a bra in Star Trek. I don't know. Alice Eve, yes.
Oh, yeah. That sounds right. Yeah.
All right, okay. Jessica, your last question.
Yes. Oh, God.
And it's a classic. After playing Jerry's love interest, Sue Ellen Mischke, legend, on Seinfeld, she went on to play Mary Alice Young on this show.
Well, Desperate Housewives, which I also recapped. This That's whole right. episode has been like a trip through my what's your recap life?
Mm-hmm.
Sue Ellen Mishke, I'm seeing her face walking down the street in her bra.
Looking like Marsha Cross, but it's not her. I'll give you that hint.
That's why my brain is like Marsha Cross. I don't have it. I'm not going to get it. It's not in there.
Anyone else?
Brenda Strong.
Oh my God. Thank you, Heather.
All right. Finally for Heather. After playing Theo's love interest, Jade, on The Cosby Show, she went on to play Rhonda Blair on this show.
God, could it just have been Brenda Strong? That would have been so much easier. Theo's love interest, Jade, on The Cosby Show, went on to play, what was the name?
Rhonda Blair.
Rhonda.
Her last name did not come up very much. I'll give you that hint, too.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
I'll give you one more hint. It's a show you 100% watched.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, wait. Okay, hang on. It's Melrose Place.
That's correct.
Ah. And it's the other Vanessa Williams.
That's correct.
Yes! Vanessa.
All right, let's get the scores.
Oh, boy. Well, this was really a family affair at the end. We finished in a tie for second place, Heather, Jessica, and I. But our winner and still non-regulation champion is David T. Cole with 17 points.
Hey, thanks, Steel Meals.
Wow.
All right, we got a tiebreaker. Let's play it for a Steel Meal. Dave, you can sit this one out. Everybody else, yell it when you know it, but let me read the whole thing first, and I will point when you can yell the answer.
Okay.
Okay?
Yes.
After playing Jerry's love interest, Jenna, on Seinfeld, she went on to play Charlotte York on this show.
Kristen Davis on Sex and the City.
You all got it, so you all get a steel meal.
Yay! Wow. So nice. So generous.
He is Palmer.
Dave!
Well, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We, Sarah, Jessica, Parkered it for the Sex and the City revival. And just like that, before going around the dial, with stops at Love Life, live in front of a studio audience, The Big Leap, The Monkees, and Call My Agent! With an exclamation point. Dan Cassino told us why he's not a crackpot for wishing 1.5 Netflix on all of us. We agreed with Laura, who wanted to believe X-Files Bad Blood was canon-worthy. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and David D. Cole, that's me, was the winner of this week's Game Time from Tara. Thank you, Tara. Next up, it's 70s action heroes making TV on Extra, Extra Hot Great. And on the next EHG Prime, it is being the Ricardos. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Shaft,
Sarah D. Bunting,
I didn't even do the with the thing.
Jessica Morgan?
Sure, fine, whatever.
And Heather Cox.
Still waiting for that Saved by the Bell Sex and the City crossover.
Yep. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time right here on Extra Hot Great.
I'm sure you didn't say all the wrong things.
You're right. I'll probably blurt out some new ones tomorrow.